until most of her body is supported by black fabric. Then Zeke pulls a strap across her shoulders, the small of her back and the top of her thighs. He pulls her, in the sling, to the edge of the building and counts down from 5. Shauna gives a thumbs up as he shoves her forward, into nothingness. Lynn gasps as Shauna hurtles toward the ground at a steep incline, head first. I push past her to see better. Shauna stays secure in the sling for as long as I can see her, and then she's too far away. Just a black speck over Lakeshore Drive. The members whoop and pump their fists and form a line, sometimes shoving one another out of the way to get a better place. Somehow, I am the first initiate in line, right in front of Uriah. Only 7 people stand between me and the zip line. Still, there is a part of me that groans. I have to wait for 7 people? It is a strange blend of terror and eagerness, unfamiliar until now. The next member, a young-looking boy with hair down to his shoulders, jumps into the sling on his back instead of his stomach. He stretches his arms wide as Zeke shoves him down the steel cable. None of the members seem at all afraid. They act like they have done this 1,000 times before, and maybe they have. But when I look over my shoulder, I see that most of the initiates look pale or worried, even if they talk excitedly to one another. What happens between initiation and membership that transforms panic into delight? Or do people just get better at hiding their fear? 3 people in front of me. Another sling. A member gets in feet first and crosses her arms over her chest. 2 people. A tall, thick boy jumps up and down like a child before climbing into the sling and lets out a high screech as he disappears, making the girl in front of me laugh. 1 person. She hops into the sling face first and keeps her hands in front of her as Zeke tightens her straps. And then it's my turn. I shudder as Zeke hangs my sling from the cable. I try to climb in, but I have trouble. My hands are shaking too badly. "Don't worry," Zeke says right next to my ear. He takes my arm and helps me get in, face down. The straps tighten around my midsection, and Zeke slides me forward to the edge of the roof. I stare down the building's steel girders and black windows, all the way to the cracked sidewalk. I am a fool for doing this, and a fool for enjoying the feeling of my heart slamming against my sternum and sweat gathering in the lines of my palms. "Ready, stiff?" Zeke smirks down at me. "I have to say I'm impressed that you aren't screaming and crying right now."
"I told you," Uriah says. "She's dauntless through and through. Now get on with it."
"Careful, brother, or I might not tighten your straps enough," Zeke says. He smacks his knee.
And then, splat.
"Yeah, yeah," Uriah says. "And then our mother would boil you alive." Hearing him talk about his mother, about his intact family, makes my chest hurt for a second, like someone pierced it with a needle. Only if she found out. Zeke tugs on the pulley attached to the steel cable. It holds, which is fortunate, because if it breaks, my death will be swift and certain. He looks down at me and says, "Ready, set, g." Before he can finish the word "go," he releases the sling and I forget him. I forget Uriah and family and all the things that could malfunction and lead to my death. I hear metal sliding against metal and feel wind so intense it forces tears into my eyes as I hurtle toward the ground. I feel like I'm without substance, without weight. Ahead of me, the marsh looks huge, its patches of brown spreading farther than I can see, even up this high. The air is so cold and so fast that it hurts my face. I pick up speed, and a shout of exhilaration rises within me, stopped only by the wind that fills my mouth the second my lips part. Held secure by the straps, I throw my arms out to the side and imagine that I'm flying. I plunge toward the street, which is cracked and patchy, and follows perfectly the curve of the marsh. I can imagine, up here, how the marsh looked when it was full of water, like liquid steel as it reflected the color of the sky. My heart beats so hard it hurts, and I can't scream and I can't breathe, but I also feel everything, every vein and every fiber,
every bone and every nerve, all awake and buzzing in my body as if charged with electricity. I am pure adrenaline. The ground grows and bulges beneath me, and I can see the tiny people standing on the pavement below. I should scream, like any rational human being would. But when I open my mouth again, I just crow with joy. I yell louder, and the figures on the ground pump their fists and yell back. But they are so far away I can barely hear them. I look down and the ground smears beneath me, all gray and white and black, glass and pavement and steel. Tendrils of wind, soft as hair, wrap around my fingers and push my arms back. I try to pull my arms to my chest again, but I am not strong enough. The ground grows bigger and bigger. I don't slow down for another minute at least, but sail parallel to the ground, like a bird. When I slow down, I run my fingers over my hair. The wind teased it into knots. I hang about 20 feet above the ground, but that height seems like nothing now. I reach behind me and work to undo the straps holding me in. My fingers shake, but I still manage to loosen them. A crowd of members stands below. They grasp one another's arms, forming a net of limbs beneath me. In order to get down, I have to trust them to catch me. I have to accept that these people are mine, and I am theirs. It is a braver act than sliding down the zip line. I wriggle forward and fall. I hit their arms hard. Wrist bones and forearms press into my back, and then palms wrap around my arms and pull me to my feet. I don't know which hands hold me and which hands don't. I see grins and hear laughter.
"What do you think?" Shauna says, clapping me on the shoulder.
All the members stare at me. They look as windblown as I feel, the frenzy of adrenaline in their eyes and their hair askew. I know why my father said the Dauntless were a pack of madmen. He didn't, couldn't, understand the kind of camaraderie that forms only after you've all risked your lives together.
"When can I go again?" I say.
My smile stretches wide enough to show teeth, and when they laugh, I laugh. I think of climbing the stairs with the abnegation, our feet finding the same rhythm, all of us the same. This isn't like that. We are not the same. But we are, somehow, one. I look toward the Hancock building, which is so far from where I stand that I can't see the people on its roof.
"Look, there he is,"
someone says, pointing over my shoulder. I follow the pointed finger toward a small dark shape, sliding down the steel wire. A few seconds later, I hear a blood-curdling scream.
"I bet he'll cry."
Zeke's brother cry? No way. He would get punched so hard.
"His arms are flailing."
"He sounds like a strangled cat," I say. Everyone laughs again. I feel a twinge of guilt for teasing Uriah when he can't hear me. But I would have said the same thing if he were standing here. I hope. When Uriah finally comes to a stop, I follow the members to meet him. We line up beneath him and thrust our arms into the space between us. Shauna clamps a hand around my elbow. I grab another arm. I'm not sure who it belongs to. There are too many tangled hands. And look up at her.
"Pretty sure we can't call you stiff anymore," Shauna says.
She nods. "Triss." I still smell like wind when I walk into the cafeteria that evening. For the second after I walk in, I stand among a crowd of Dauntless, and I feel like one of them. Then Shauna waves to me and the crowd breaks apart, and I walk toward the table where Christina, Al, and Will sit, gaping at me. I didn't think about them when I accepted Uriah's invitation. In a way, it is satisfying to see stunned looks on their faces, but I don't want them to be upset with me either.
"Where were you?"
asks Christina.
"What were you doing with them?"
"Uriah. You know, the Dauntless born, who was on our Capture the Flag team," I say. "He was leaving with some of the members and he begged them to let me come along. They didn't really want me there. Some girl named Lynn stepped on me."
"They may not have wanted you there then," says Will quietly,
"but they seem to like you now."
"Yeah," I say. "I can't deny it.
I'm glad to be back, though. Hopefully they can't tell I'm lying, but I suspect they can. I caught sight of myself in a window on the way into the compound, and my cheeks and eyes were both bright, my hair tangled. I look like I have experienced something powerful.
Well, you miss Christina almost punching an erudite, says Al. His voice sounds eager.
I can count on Al to try to break the tension. He was here asking for opinions about the abnegation leadership, and Christina told him there were more important things for him to be doing. Which she was completely right about, adds Will. And he got testy with her. Big mistake.
Huge, I say, nodding.
If I smile enough, maybe I can make them forget their jealousy, or hurt, or whatever is brewing behind Christina's eyes.
Yeah, she says.
While you were off having fun, I was doing the dirty work of defending your old faction, eliminating interfaction conflict.
Come on, you know you enjoyed it, says Will, nudging her with his elbow.
If you're not going to tell the whole story, I will.
He was standing.
Will launches into his story, and I nod along like I'm listening, but all I can think about is staring down the side of the Hancock building, and the image I got of the marsh full of water, restored to its former glory. I look over Will's shoulder at the members, who are now flicking bits of food at one another with their forks.
It's the first time I have been really eager to be one of them, which means I have to survive the next stage of initiation.
Chapter 18. As far as I can tell, the second stage of initiation involves sitting in a dark hallway with the other initiates, wondering what's going to happen behind a closed door. Uriah sits across from me, with Marlene on his left and Lynn on his right. The Dauntless-born initiates and the transfers were separated during stage one, but we will be training together from now on. That's what Four told us, before he disappeared behind the door.
So, says Lynn, scuffing the floor with her shoe.
Which one of you is ranked first, huh?
Her question is met with silence at first, and then Peter clears his throat.
Me, he says.
Bet I could take you,
she says it casually, turning the ring in her eyebrow with her fingertips.
I'm second, but I bet any of us could take you, transfer.
I almost laugh. If I was still abnegation, her comment would be rude and out of place. But among the Dauntless, challenges like that seem common. I am almost starting to expect them.
I wouldn't be so sure about that if I were you, Peter says, his eyes glittering.
Who's first?
Uriah, she says.
And I'm sure. You know how many years we've spent preparing for this.
If she intends to intimidate us, it works. I already feel colder.
Before Peter can respond, Four opens the door and says, Lynn.
He beckons to her, and she walks down the hallway, the blue light at the end making her bare head glow.
So you're first, Will says to Uriah.
Uriah shrugs.
Yeah, and?
And you don't think it's a little unfair that you've spent your entire life getting ready for this, and we're expected to learn it all in a few weeks? Will says, his eyes narrowing.
Not really. Stage one was about skill, sure. But no one can prepare for stage two, he says. At least so I'm told.
No one responds to that. We sit in silence for 20 minutes. I count each minute on my watch.
Then the door opens again, and Four calls another name.
Peter, he says.
Each minute wears into me like a scrape of sandpaper. Gradually, our numbers begin to dwindle, and it's just me and Uriah and Drew. Drew's leg bounces, and Uriah's fingers tap against his knee, and I try to sit perfectly still. I hear only muttering from the room at the end of the hallway, and I suspect this is another part of the game they like to play with us, terrifying us at every opportunity. The door opens, and Four beckons to me.
Come on, Tris.
I stand, my back sore from leaning against the wall for so long, and walk past the other initiates. Drew sticks out his leg to trip me, but I hop over it at the last second. Four touches my shoulder to guide me into the room and closes the door behind me. When I see what's inside, I recoil immediately, my shoulders hitting his chest. In the room is a reclining metal chair,
similar to the one I sat in during the aptitude test. Beside it is a familiar machine. This room has no mirrors, and barely any light. There's a computer screen on a desk in the corner.
Sit, Four says. He squeezes my arms and pushes me forward.
What's the simulation? I say, trying to keep my voice from shaking. I don't succeed.
Ever hear the phrase, face your fears? He says.
We're taking that literally. The simulation will teach you to control your emotions in the midst of a frightening situation. I touch a wavering hand to my forehead. Simulations aren't real. They pose no real threat to me, so logically, I shouldn't be afraid of them. But my reaction is visceral. It takes all the willpower I have for me to steer myself toward the chair and sit down in it again, pressing my skull into the headrest. The cold from the metal seeps through my clothes.
Do you ever administer the aptitude tests? I say.
He seems qualified.
No, he replies. I avoid stiffs as much as possible.
I don't know why someone would avoid the abnegation. The dauntless or the candor, maybe. Because bravery and honesty make people do strange things. But the abnegation?
Why?
Do you ask me that because you think I'll actually answer?
Why do you say vague things if you don't want to be asked about them?
His fingers brush my neck. My body tenses. A tender gesture?
No. He has to move my hair to the side.
He taps something, and I tilt my head back to see what it is. Four holds a syringe with a long needle in one hand, his thumb against the plunger. The liquid in the syringe is tinted orange.
An injection?
My mouth goes dry. I don't usually mind needles, but this one is huge.
We use a more advanced version of the simulation here, he says. A different serum, no wires or electrodes for you.
How does it work without wires?
Well, I have wires, so I can see what's going on, he says. But for you, there's a tiny transmitter in the serum that sends data to the computer.
He turns my arm over and eases the tip of the needle into the tender skin on the side of my neck. A deep ache spreads through my throat. I wince and try to focus on his calm face.
The serum will go into effect in 60 seconds. This simulation is different from the aptitude test, he says.
In addition to containing the transmitter, the serum stimulates the amygdala, which is the part of the brain involved in processing negative emotions, like fear, and then induces a hallucination. The brain's electrical activity is then transmitted to our computer, which then translates your hallucination into a simulated image that I can see and monitor. I will then forward the recording to Dauntless administrators. You stay in the hallucination until you calm down. That is, lower your heart rate and control your breathing.
I try to follow his words, but my thoughts are going haywire. I feel the trademark symptoms of fear. Sweaty palms, racing heart, tightness in my chest, dry mouth, a lump in my throat, difficulty breathing. He plants his hands on either side of my head and leans over me.
Be brave, Triss, he whispers. The first time is always the hardest.
His eyes are the last thing I see.
I stand in a field of dry grass that comes up to my waist. The air smells like smoke and burns my nostrils. Above me, the sky is bile-colored, and the sight of it fills me with anxiety, my body cringing away from it. I hear fluttering, like the pages of a book blown by the wind, but there is no wind. The air is still and soundless, apart from the flapping, neither hot nor cold. Not like air at all, but I can still breathe. A shadow swoops overhead. Something lands on my shoulder. I feel its weight and the prick of talons, and fling my arm forward to shake it off, my hand batting at it. I feel something smooth and fragile, a feather. I bite my lip and look to the side. A black bird the size of my forearm turns its head and focuses one beady eye on me. I grip my teeth and hit the crow again with my hand. It digs in its talons and doesn't move. I cry out, more frustrated than pained, and hit the crow with both hands. But it stays in place, resolute, one eye on me, feathers gleaming in the yellow light. Thunder rumbles, and I hear the patter of rain on the ground, but no rain falls. The sky darkens, like a cloud is passing over the sun. Still cringing away from the crow, I look up. A flock of crows storms toward me, an advancing army of outstretched talons and open beaks, each one squawking, filling the air with noise. The crows descend in a single mass, diving toward the earth, hundreds of beady black eyes shining. I try to run, but my feet are firmly planted and refuse to move, like the crow on my shoulder. I scream as they surround me, feathers flapping in my ears, beaks pecking at my shoulders, talons clinging to my clothes. I scream until tears come from my eyes, my arms flailing. My hands hit solid bodies but do nothing. There are too many. I am alone. They nip at my fingertips and press against my body, wings sliding across the back of my neck, feet tearing at my hair. I twist and wrench and fall to the ground, covering my head with my arms. They scream against me. I feel a wiggling in the grass, a crow forcing its way under my arm. I open my eyes and it pecks at my face, its beak hitting me in the nose. Blood drips onto the grass and I sob, hitting it with my palm. But another crow wedges under my other arm, and its claws stick to the front of my shirt. I'm screaming. I'm sobbing. Help! I wail. Help! And the crows flap harder, a roar in my ears. My body burns, and they are everywhere, and I can't think. I can't breathe. I gasp for air, and my mouth fills with feathers. Feathers down my throat, in my lungs, replacing my blood with dead weight. Help! I sob and scream, insensible, illogical. I am dying. I am dying. I am dying. My skin sears, and I am bleeding, and the squawking is so loud my ears are ringing. But I am not dying, and I remember that it isn't real, but it feels real. It feels so real. Be brave. Four's voice screams in my memory. I cry out to him, inhaling feathers and exhaling, help! But there will be no help. I am alone. You stay in the hallucination until you can calm down. His voice continues, and I cough, and my face is wet with tears, and another crow has wriggled under my arms, and I feel the edge of its sharp beak against my mouth. Its beak wedges past my lips and scrapes my teeth. The crow pushes its head into my mouth, and I bite hard, tasting something foul. I spit and clench my teeth to form a barrier. But now a fourth crow is pushing at my feet, and a fifth crow is pecking at my ribs. Calm down. I can't, I can't. My head throbs. Breathe. I keep my mouth closed and suck air into my nose. It has been hours since I was alone in the field. It has been days. I push air out of my nose. My heart pounds hard in my chest. I have to slow it down. I breathe again, my face wet with tears. I sob again and force myself forward, stretching out on the grass, which prickles against my skin. I extend my arms and breathe. Crows push and prod at my sides, worming their way beneath me, and I let them. I let the flapping of wings and the squawking and the pecking and the prodding continue, relaxing one muscle at a time, resigning myself to becoming a pecked carcass. The pain overwhelms me. I open my eyes, and I am sitting in the metal chair. I scream and hit my arms and head and legs to get the birds off me, but they are gone, though I can still feel the feathers brushing the back of my neck and the talons in my shoulder and my burning skin. I moan and pull my knees to my chest, burying my face in them. A hand touches my shoulder, and I fling a fist out, hitting something solid but soft. Don't touch me, I sob. It's over, Four says. The hand shifts awkwardly over my hair, and I remember my father stroking my hair when he kissed me goodnight, my mother touching my hair when she trimmed it with the scissors. I run my palms along my arms, still brushing off feathers, though I know there aren't any. Triss. I rock back and forth in the metal chair. Triss, I'm going to take you back to the dorms, okay?
No!
I snap. I lift my head and glare at him, though I can't see him through the blur of tears.
They can't see me. Not like this. Oh, calm down, he says. He rolls his eyes. I'll take you out the back door. I don't need you to... I shake my head. My body is trembling, and I feel so weak I'm not sure I can stand. But I have to try. I can't be the only one who needs to be walked back to the dorms. Even if they don't see me, they'll find out. They'll talk about me. Nonsense. He grabs my arm and hauls me out of the chair. I blink the tears from my eyes, wipe my cheeks with the heel of my hand, and let him steer me toward the door behind the computer screen. We walk down the hallway in silence. When we're a few hundred yards away from the room, I yank my arm away and stop. Why did you do that to me? I say. What was the point of that, huh? I wasn't aware that when I chose Dauntless, I was signing up for weeks of torture. Did you think overcoming cowardice would be easy? He says calmly. That isn't overcoming cowardice. Cowardice is how you decide to be in real life. And in real life, I'm not getting pecked to death by crows for. I press my palms to my face and sob into them. He doesn't say anything, just stands there as I cry. It only takes me a few seconds to stop and wipe my face again. I want to go home, I say weakly. But home is not an option anymore. My choices are here or the factionless slums. He doesn't look at me with sympathy. He just looks at me. His eyes look black in the dim corridor, and his mouth is set in a hard line. Learning how to think in the midst of fear, he says, is a lesson that everyone, even your stiff family, needs to learn. That's what we're trying to teach you. If you can't learn it, you'll need to get the hell out of here, because we won't want you. I'm trying. My lower lip trembles. But I failed. I'm failing. He sighs. How long do you think you spent in that hallucination, Triss? I don't know. I shake my head. A half hour? 3 minutes, he replies. You got out 3 times faster than the other initiates. Whatever you are, you're not a failure. 3 minutes? He smiles a little. Tomorrow you'll be better at this. You'll see. Tomorrow? He touches my back and guides me toward the dormitory. I feel his fingertips through my shirt. Their gentle pressure makes me forget the birds for a moment. What was your first hallucination? I say, glancing at him. It wasn't a what, so much as a who. He shrugs. It's not important. And are you over that fear now? Not yet. We reach the door to the dormitory, and he leans against the wall, sliding his hands into his pockets. I may never be. So they don't go away? Sometimes they do, and sometimes new fears replace them. His thumbs hook around his belt loops. But becoming fearless isn't the point. That's impossible. It's learning how to control your fear, and how to be free from it. That's the point. I nod. I used to think the Dauntless were fearless. That is how they seemed, anyway. But maybe what I saw as fearless was actually fear under control. Anyway, your fears are rarely what they appear to be in the simulation, he adds. What do you mean? Well, are you really afraid of crows? He says, half smiling at me. The expression warms his eyes enough that I forget he's my instructor. He's just a boy, talking casually, walking me to my door. When you see one, do you run away screaming? No, I guess not. I think about stepping closer to him. Not for any practical reason, but just because I want to see what it would be like to stand that close to him, just because I want to. Foolish, a voice in my head says. I step closer and lean against the wall too, tilting my head sideways to look at him. As I did on the Ferris wheel, I know exactly how much space there is between us. 6 inches. I lean. Less than 6 inches. I feel warmer, like he's giving off some kind of energy that I am only now close enough to feel. So what am I really afraid of? I say. I don't know, he says. Only you can know. I nod slowly. There are 12 things it could be, but I'm not sure which one is right, or if there's even one right one. I didn't know becoming dauntless would be this difficult, I say. And a second later, I am surprised that I said it. Surprised that I admitted to it. I bite the inside of my cheek and watch Four carefully. Was it a mistake to tell him that? It wasn't always like this, I'm told, he says, lifting a shoulder. My admission doesn't appear to bother him. Being dauntless, I mean. What changed? The leadership, he says. The person who controls training sets the standard of dauntless behavior. 6 years ago, Max and the other leaders changed the training methods to make them more competitive and more brutal. Said it was supposed to test people's strength. And that changed the priorities of Dauntless as a whole. Bet you can't guess who the leader's new protege is. The answer is obvious. Eric. They trained him to be vicious, and now he will train the rest of us to be vicious too. I look at Four. Their training didn't work on him. So, if you were ranked first in your initiate class, I say, what was Eric's rank? Second. So he was their second choice for leadership. I nod slowly. And you were their first. What makes you say that? The way Eric was acting at dinner the first night. Jealous even though he has what he wants. Four doesn't contradict me. I must be right. I want to ask why he didn't take the position the leaders offered him. Why he is so resistant to leadership when he seems to be a natural leader. But I know how Four feels about personal questions. I sniff, wipe my face one more time, and smooth down my hair. Do I look like I've been crying? I say. He leans in close, narrowing his eyes like he's inspecting my face. A smile tugs at the corner of his mouth. Even closer, so we would be breathing the same air, if I could remember to breathe. No, Triss, he says. A more serious look replaces his smile as he adds, You look tough as nails. Chapter 19. When I walk in, most of the other initiates, dauntless born and transfer alike, are crowded between the rows of bunk beds with Peter at their center. He holds a piece of paper in both hands. The mass exodus of the Children of Abnegation leaders cannot be ignored or attributed to coincidence, he reads. The recent transfer of Beatrice and Caleb Pryor, the children of Andrew Pryor, calls into question the soundness of Abnegation's values and teachings. Cold creeps up my spine. Christina, standing on the edge of the crowd, looks over her shoulder and spots me. She gives me a worried look. I can't move. My father. Now the erudite are attacking my father. Why else would the children of such an important man decide that the lifestyle he has set out for them is not an admirable one? Peter continues. Molly Atwood, a fellow dauntless transfer, suggests a disturbed and abusive upbringing might be to blame. I heard her talking in her sleep once, Molly says. She was telling her father to stop doing something. I don't know what it was, but it gave her nightmares. So this is Molly's revenge. She must have talked to the erudite reporter that Christina yelled at. She smiles. Her teeth are crooked. If I knock them out, I might be doing her a favor. What? I demand. Or I try to demand, but my voice comes out strangled and scratchy, and I have to clear my throat and say it again. What? Peter stops reading, and a few people turn around. Some, like Christina, look at me in a pitying way, their eyebrows drawn in, their mouths turned down at the corners. But most give me little smirks, and eye one another suggestively. Peter turns last, with a wide smile. Give me that, I say, holding out my hand. My face burns. But I'm not done reading, he replies, laughter in his voice. His eyes scan the paper again. However, perhaps the answer lies not in a morally bereft man, but in the corrupted ideals of an entire faction. Perhaps the answer is that we have entrusted our city to a group of proselytizing tyrants who do not know how to lead us out of poverty and into prosperity. I storm up to him and try to snatch the paper from his hands, but he holds it up,
high above my head so I can't reach it unless I jump, and I won't jump. Instead, I lift my heel and stomp as hard as I can where the bones in his foot connect to his toes. He grits his teeth to stifle a groan. Then I throw myself at Molly, hoping the force of the impact will surprise her and knock her down. But before I can do any damage, cold hands close around my waist. "That's my father!" I scream. "My father, you coward!" Will pulls me away from her, lifting me off the ground. My breaths come fast, and I struggle to grab the paper before anyone can read another word of it. I have to burn it. I have to destroy it. I have to. Will drags me out of the room and into the hallway, his fingernails digging into my skin. Once the door shuts behind him, he lets go, and I shove him as hard as I can. "What? Did you think I couldn't defend myself against that piece of candor trash?" "No," says Will. He stands in front of the door. "I figured I'd stop you from starting a brawl in the dormitory. Calm down." I laugh a little. "Calm down? Calm down? That's my family they're talking about. That's my faction." "No, it's not." There are dark circles under his eyes. He looks exhausted. "It's your old faction, and there's nothing you can do about what they say, so you might as well just ignore it." "Were you even listening?" The heat in my cheeks is gone, and my breaths are more even now. "Your stupid ex-faction isn't just insulting abnegation anymore. They're calling for an overthrow of the entire government." Will laughs. "No, they're not. They're arrogant and dull, and that's why I left them. But they aren't revolutionaries. They just want more say, that's all. And they resent abnegation for refusing to listen to them." "They don't want people to listen. They want people to agree," I reply. "And you shouldn't bully people into agreeing with you." I touch my palms to my cheeks. I can't believe my brother joined them. "Hey, they're not all bad," he says sharply. I nod, but I don't believe him. I can't imagine anyone emerging from the erudite unscathed, though Will seems all right. The door opens again, and Christina and Al walk out. "It's my turn to get tattooed," she says. "Wanna come with us?" I smooth my hair. I can't go back into the dormitory. Even if Will let me, I am outnumbered there. My only choice is to go with them and try to forget what's happening outside the Dauntless compound. I have enough to worry about without anxiety about my family. Ahead of me, Al gives Christina a piggyback ride. She shrieks as he charges through the crowd. People give him a wide berth when they can. My shoulder still burns. Christina persuaded me to join her in getting a tattoo of the Dauntless seal. It is a circle with a flame inside it. My mother didn't even react to the one on my collarbone, so I don't have as many reservations about getting tattoos. They are a part of life here, just as integral to my initiation as learning to fight. Christina also persuaded me to purchase a shirt that exposes my shoulders and collarbone, and to line my eyes with black pencil again. I don't bother objecting to her makeover attempts anymore, especially since I find myself enjoying them. Will and I walk behind Christina and Al. "I can't believe you got another tattoo," he says, shaking his head. "Why?" I say. "Because I'm a stiff?" "No, because you're sensible." He smiles. His teeth are white and straight. "So, what was your fear today, Tris?" "Too many crows," I reply. "You?" He laughs. "Too much acid." I don't ask what that means. "It's really fascinating how it all works," he says. "It's basically a struggle between your thalamus, which is producing the fear, and your frontal lobe, which makes decisions. But the simulation is all in your head, so even though you feel like someone is doing it to you, it's just you, doing it to yourself. And..." He trails off. "Sorry. I sound like an erudite. Just a habit." I shrug. "It's interesting." Al almost drops Christina, and she slaps her hands around the first thing she can grab, which just happens to be his face. He cringes and adjusts his grip on her legs. At a glance, Al seems happy, but there is something heavy about even his smiles. I am worried about him. I see Four standing by the chasm, a group of people around him. He laughs so hard he has to grab the railing for balance. Judging by the bottle in his hand and the brightness of his face, he's intoxicated, or on his way there. I had begun to think of Four as rigid, like a soldier, and forgot that he's also 18.
Uh-oh, says Will. Instructor alert.
At least it's not Eric, I say. He'd probably make us play chicken or something.
Sure, but Four is scary. Remember when he put the gun up to Peter's head? I think Peter wet himself.
Peter deserved it, I say firmly. Will doesn't argue with me. He might have a few weeks ago, but now we've all seen what Peter is capable of.
Triss! Four calls out.
Will and I exchange a look, half surprise and half apprehension. Four pulls away from the railing and walks up to me. Ahead of us, Al and Christina stop running, and Christina slides to the ground. I don't blame them for staring. There are four of us, and Four is only talking to me.
You look different.
His words, normally crisp, are now sluggish.
So do you, I say.
And he does. He looks more relaxed, younger.
What are you doing?
Flirting with death, he replies with a laugh. Drinking near the chasm. Probably not a good idea.
No, it isn't. I'm not sure I like Four this way. There's something unsettling about it.
Didn't know you had a tattoo, he says, looking at my collarbone.
He sips the bottle. His breath smells thick and sharp, like the factionless man's breath.
Right, the crows, he says.
He glances over his shoulder at his friends, who are carrying on without him, unlike mine. He adds,
I'd ask you to hang out with us, but you're not supposed to see me this way.
I am tempted to ask him why he wants me to hang out with him, but I suspect the answer has something to do with the bottle in his hand.
What way? I ask. Drunk?
Yeah. Well, no.
His voice softens.
Real, I guess.
I'll pretend I didn't.
Nice of you.
He puts his lips next to my ear and says,
You look good, Triss.
His words surprise me, and my heart leaps. I wish it didn't, because judging by the way his eyes slide over mine, he has no idea what he's saying. I laugh. Do me a favor, and stay away from the chasm, okay?
Of course.
He winks at me. I can't help it. I smile. Will clears his throat, but I don't want to turn away from Four, even when he walks back to his friends. Then Al rushes at me like a rolling boulder and throws me over his shoulder. I shriek, my face hot.
Come on, little girl, he says. I'm taking you to dinner.
I rest my elbows on Al's back and wave at Four as he carries me away.
I thought I would rescue you,
Al says as we walk away. He sets me down.
What was that all about?
He is trying to sound lighthearted, but he asks the question almost sadly. He still cares too much about me.
Yeah, I think we'd all like to know the answer to that question, says Christina in a sing-song voice.
What did he say to you?
Nothing.
I shake my head. He was drunk. He didn't even know what he was saying. I clear my throat.
That's why I was grinning. It's funny to see him that way.
Right, says Will.
Couldn't possibly be because...
I elbow Will hard in the ribs before he can finish his sentence. He was close enough to hear what Four said to me about looking good. I don't need him telling everyone about it, especially not Al. I don't want to make him feel worse. At home, I used to spend calm, pleasant nights with my family. My mother knit scarves for the neighborhood kids. My father helped Caleb with his homework. There was a fire in the fireplace, and peace in my heart, as I was doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, and everything was quiet. I have never been carried around by a large boy, or laughed until my stomach hurt at the dinner table, or listened to the clamor of 100 people all talking at once. Peace is restrained. This is free.
Chapter 20. I breathe through my nose. In, out, in.
It's just a simulation, Triss, Four says quietly.
He's wrong. The last simulation bled into my life. Waking and sleeping. Nightmares. Not just featuring the crows, but the feelings I had in the simulation. Terror and helplessness, which I suspect is what I am really afraid of. Sudden fits of terror in the shower, at breakfast, on the way here. Nails bitten down so far my nail beds ache. And I'm not the only one who feels this way. I can tell. Still, I nod and close my eyes. I am in darkness. The last thing I remember is the metal chair and the needle in my arm. This time, there is no field. There are no crows. My heart pounds in anticipation. What monsters will creep from the darkness and steal my rationality? How long will I have to wait for them? A blue orb lights up a few feet ahead of me, and then another one, filling the room with light. I am on the pit floor, next to the chasm, and the initiates stand around me, their arms folded and their faces blank. I search for Christina and find her standing among them. None of them move. Their stillness makes my throat feel tight. I see something in front of me, my own faint reflection. I touch it, and my fingers find glass, cool and smooth. I look up. There's a pane above me. I'm in a glass box. I press above my head to see if I can force the box open. It doesn't budge. I am sealed in. My heart beats faster. I don't want to be trapped. Someone taps on the wall in front of me. Four. He points at my feet, smirking. A few seconds ago, my feet were dry, but now I stand in half an inch of water, and my socks are soggy. I crouch to see where the water is coming from, but it seems to be coming from nowhere, rising up from the box's glass bottom. I look up at Four, and he shrugs. He joins the crowd of initiates. The water rises fast. It now covers my ankles. I pound against the glass with my fist. Hey, I say, let me out of here. The water slides up my bare calves as it rises, cool and soft. I hit the glass harder. Get me out of here. I stare at Christina. She leans over to Peter, who stands beside her, and whispers something in his ear. They both laugh. The water covers my thighs. I pound my fists against the glass. I'm not trying to get their attention anymore. I'm trying to break out. Frantic, I bang against the glass as hard as I can. I step back and throw my shoulder into the wall. Once, twice, three times, four times. I hit the wall until my shoulder aches, screaming for help, watching the water rise to my waist, my ribcage, my chest. Help! I scream. Please, please help! I slap the glass. I will die in this tank. I drag my shaking hands through my hair. I see Will standing among the initiates, and something tickles at the back of my mind. Something he said. Come on, think. I stop trying to break the glass. It's hard to breathe, but I have to try. I'll need as much air as I can get in a few seconds. My body rises, weightless in the water. I float closer to the ceiling, and tilt my head back as the water covers my chin. Gasping, I press my face to the glass above me, sucking in as much air as I can. Then the water covers me, sealing me into the box. Don't panic. It's no use. My heart pounds and my thoughts scatter. I thrash in the water, smacking the walls. I kick the glass as hard as I can, but the water slows down my foot. The simulation is all in your head. I scream, and water fills my mouth. If it's in my head, I control it. The water burns my eyes. The initiates' passive faces stare back at me. They don't care. I scream again and shove the wall with my palm. I hear something, a cracking sound. When I pull my hand away, there is a line in the glass. I slam my other hand next to the first and drive another crack through the glass, this one spreading outward from my palm in long, crooked fingers. My chest burns like I just swallowed fire. I kick the wall. My toes ache from the impact,
and I hear a long, low groan. The pain shatters, and the force of the water against my back throws me forward. There is air again. I gasp and sit up. I'm in the chair. I gulp and shake out my hands. Forrest stands to my right, but instead of helping me up, he just looks at me.
What?
I ask.
How did you do that?
Do what?
Crack the glass.
I don't know. Forrest finally offers me his hand. I swing my legs over the side of the chair, and when I stand, I feel steady, calm. He sighs and grabs me by the elbow, half leading and half dragging me out of the room. We walk quickly down the hallway, and then I stop, pulling my arm back. He stares at me in silence. He won't give me information without prompting.
What?
I demand.
You're divergent, he replies.
I stare at him, fear pulsing through me like electricity.
He knows. How does he know? I must have slipped up, said something wrong.
I should act casual. I lean back, pressing my shoulders to the wall and say,
What's divergent?
Don't play stupid, he says. I suspected it last time, but this time it's obvious. You manipulated the simulation. You're divergent. I'll delete the footage, but unless you want to wind up dead at the bottom of the chasm, you'll figure out how to hide it during the simulations. Now, if you'll excuse me.
He walks back to the simulation room and slams the door behind him. I feel my heartbeat in my throat. I manipulated the simulation. I broke the glass. I didn't know that was an act of divergence.
How did he?
I push myself away from the wall and start down the hallway. I need answers, and I know who has them. I walk straight to the tattoo place, where I last saw Tori. There aren't many people out, because it's mid-afternoon, and most of them are at work or at school. There are three people in the tattoo place. The other tattoo artist, who was drawing a lion on another man's arm, and Tori, who was sorting through a stack of paper on the counter. She looks up when I walk in.
Hello, Triss, she says.
She glances at the other tattoo artist, who is too focused on what he's doing to notice us.
Let's go in the back.
I follow her behind the curtain that separates the two rooms. The next room contains a few chairs, spare tattoo needles, ink, pads of paper, and framed artwork. Tori draws the curtain shut and sits in one of the chairs. I sit next to her, tapping my feet to give myself something to do.
What's going on? She says. How are the simulations going?
Really well. I nod a few times. A little too well, I hear.
Ah.
Please help me understand, I say quietly.
What does it mean to be?
I hesitate. I should not say the word divergent here.
What the hell am I? What does it have to do with the simulations?
Tori's demeanor changes. She leans back and crosses her arms. Her expression becomes guarded.
Among other things, you are someone who is aware, when they are in a simulation, that what they are experiencing is not real, she says.
Someone who can then manipulate the simulation or even shut it down. And also, she leans forward and looks into my eyes,
someone who, because you are also dauntless, tends to die.
A weight settles on my chest, like each sentence she speaks is piling there. Tension builds inside me until I can't stand to hold it in anymore. I have to cry, or scream, or... I let out a harsh little laugh that dies almost as soon as it's born and say,
So I'm going to die then?
Not necessarily, she says. The Dauntless leaders don't know about you yet. I deleted your aptitude results from the system immediately and manually logged your result as abnegation. But make no mistake, if they discover what you are, they will kill you.
I stare at her in silence. She doesn't look crazy. She sounds steady, if a little urgent, and I've never suspected her of being unbalanced, but she must be. There hasn't been a murder in our city as long as I've been alive. Even if individuals are capable of it, the leaders of a faction can't possibly be.
You're paranoid, I say. The leaders of the Dauntless wouldn't kill me. People don't do that. Not anymore.
That's the point of all this. All the factions.
Oh, you think so?
She plants her hands on her knees and stares right at me, her features taut with sudden ferocity.
They got my brother. Why not you, huh? What makes you special?
Your brother? I say, narrowing my eyes.
Yeah, my brother. He and I both transferred from Erudite. Only his aptitude test was inconclusive. On the last day of simulations, they found his body in the chasm. Said it was a suicide. Only my brother was doing well in training. He was dating another initiate. He was happy.
She shakes her head.
You have a brother, right? Don't you think you would know if he was suicidal?
I try to imagine Caleb killing himself. Even the thought sounds ridiculous to me. Even if Caleb was miserable, it would not be an option.
Her sleeves are rolled up, so I can see a tattoo of a river on her right arm. Did she get it after her brother died? Was the river another fear she overcame?
She lowers her voice.
In the second stage of training, Georgie got really good, really fast. He said the simulations weren't even scary to him. They were like a game. So the instructors took a special interest in him. Piled into the room when he went under, instead of just letting the instructor report his results. Whispered about him all the time. The last day of simulations, one of the Dauntless leaders came in to see it himself. And the next day, Georgie was gone. I could be good at the simulations. If I mastered whatever force helped me break the glass. I could be so good that all the instructors took notice.
I could, but will I?
Is that all it is? I say. Just changing the simulations?
I doubt it, she says. But that's all I know.
How many people know about this? I say, thinking of four. About manipulating the simulations.
Two kinds of people, she says. People who want you dead, or people who have experienced it themselves. First-hand, or second-hand, like me.
Four told me he would delete the recording of me breaking the glass. He doesn't want me dead. Is he divergent? Was a family member? A friend? A girlfriend?
I push the thought aside. I can't let him distract me.
I don't understand, I said slowly. Why the Dauntless leaders care that I can manipulate the simulation?
If I had it figured out, I would have told you by now.
She presses her lips together.
The only thing I've come up with is that changing the simulation isn't what they care about. It's just a symptom of something else. Something they do care about.
Tori takes my hand and presses it between her palms.
Think about this, she says. These people taught you how to use a gun. They taught you how to fight. You think they're above hurting you? Above killing you?
She releases my hand and stands.
I have to go or Bud will ask questions. Be careful, Triss.
Chapter 21. The door to the pit closes behind me, and I am alone. I have not walked this tunnel since the day of the choosing ceremony. I remember how I walked it then, my footsteps unsteady, searching for light. I walk it sure-footed now. I don't need light anymore. It has been 4 days since I spoke to Tori. Since then, Erudite has released 2 articles about abnegation. The first article accuses abnegation of withholding luxuries, like cars and fresh fruit, from the other factions, in order to force their belief in self-denial on everyone else. When I read it, I thought of Will's sister, Kara, accusing my mother of hoarding goods. The second article discusses the failings of choosing government officials based on their faction, asking why only people who define themselves as selfless should be in government. It promotes a return to the democratically elected political systems of the past. It makes a lot of sense, which makes me suspect it is a call for revolution wrapped in the clothing of rationality. I reach the end of the tunnel. The net stretches across the gaping hole, just as it did when I last saw it. I climb the stairs to the wooden platform, where Four pulled me to solid ground and grabbed the bar that the net is attached to. I would not have been able to lift my body up with just my arms when I first got here, but now I do it almost without thinking and roll into the center of the net. Above me are the empty buildings that stand at the edge of the hole, and the sky.
It is dark blue and starless. There is no moon. The articles troubled me.